diameter. Things that are measured with diameters are usually complex structures, like a neutron or a proton has a defined diameter because it's made out of three fundamental quarks and some and gluons to keep them all together. So it's the distance between the peaks of those quarks that we measure as a dimension. So the more you jump into physics, the stranger and stranger it gets. But I sort of can believe that space-time itself can expand at any rate. It's moving stuff through space-time that you hit a speed limit, the speed limit of causality. Things cannot appear to happen any faster than a certain point. Otherwise, nothing makes sense anymore.
Sure about the firewall, Mr. Roy?
Roy, is there anything in your mind that can go faster than the speed of light? I think the answer is no. I think these tachyons...
Repeater, timeout.
I think those tachyons are a nice theoretical particle, but I don't think they're real. How about you, Roy?
I agree. I think they're completely theoretical. They're based on a weird idea of imaginary matter, which I don't know what the hell that really means. But it plugs into the equations well, and that's the only thing. It's a curiosity for mathematics. It makes no sense to me that if you drain a particle of all of its energy, it travels at an infinite speed. That gives me a headache. That if you give it an infinite amount of energy, it slows down to just a little bit faster than the speed of light. So as far as I'm aware, anything with a rest mass can't travel at the speed of light. Anything with a zero rest mass can't travel at anything but the speed of light, and nothing travels faster than the speed of light through space. You gotta say through space, because again, space itself can expand at any rate it wants to.
The Star Trek, let me drop it. Star Trek very conveniently talked about going warp 8. Or even going warp 2. Nice science fiction. And beaming down means you didn't have to go through this climbing in the shuttlecraft and going through the whole procedure of getting down to the surface. So beaming down made their production a lot easier. But this warp 2 and warp 8 jazz, nice science fiction. I don't think there's even the slightest hint that that can become reality. That's a guess on my part. What do you think about warp 8, Roy?
It's a wonderful trick for a science fiction show, and it works beautifully because we don't have the time to wait for them to travel to the next solar system in a couple hundred years. So I applaud them for creative writing, but I don't think it's possible. The closest thing to that, and Kip Thorne, I think you are aware of Kip Thorne, is wormholes, but wormholes have all kinds of problems. They require something called negative energy to keep them open, and even if you could create them, which no one knows how, and maintain them, which no one knows how, and trap them and move them where you want to, which no one knows how, the opening would be so small that you wouldn't get anything to pass through it. A simple quark would be too big to pass through the thinnest portion of the canal of a wormhole. It's a very interesting concept. Anyone want to Google Einstein-Rosen Bridge? Those two guys thought this up, and they've been using it in science fiction ever since. But that seems to be the go-to, close-to-reality theory that people are using to travel faster than the speed of light.
Is there any hint that a wormhole has ever really existed? Or is this really a figment of a couple of imaginations, Roy?
Again, it is all incredibly theoretical. There is no evidence whatsoever that it ever existed, that it exists now, that it ever will exist in the future. It's a very interesting theory that has some nice mathematics involved, but again, it introduces things that are kind of difficult to explain, like where do you get negative energy from, and things like that. So, you know, when you start to pull odd things out of your pocket to maintain a theoretical construct, it's usually a sign that there's something terribly wrong. But you know, it makes for great science fiction, so what the hell? I enjoy watching it on TV.
I've got a sudden guess that in the last the conversations I had with you last week and this week, it's going to sound like a very divergent analysis, like we're almost jumping to another subject. I've got a sudden guess as to why it's so difficult to figure out what gravity really is. It'll take me about a paragraph. Would you mind if I tried it on you right now?
Have a comment.
Feel free, Dick. I love theories.
Whenever a brand new engineer uses one of his favorite computer modeling programs, and he does an error in the way he models the device under test, or he does an error in the way he uses the mathematics, he ends up dividing almost by zero, and he comes up with numbers of 890 dB is the signal strength increase or decrease. When you come up with 890 dB, which is 10 with 89 zeros after it, nothing in the reasonable universe ever comes up with numbers those big. Okay. Roy just told us that the weak force versus the strong, gravity versus the strong force differ by 37 orders of magnitude. If I convert that to decibels, that's 370 dB. The difference between the strength of the strong force and gravity. Gravity is so darn weak. I'm now going to show you a real example of life as to how difficult that is. Let me drop. As I said, some of the young pup engineers that I've worked with will occasionally come up with 800 dB type errors coming out of the computer program, and they don't question it. And I got to slowly teach them, whenever you get a number that big, get very skeptical. That ain't real. Okay. What's the biggest real number I have ever worked with? One of the biggest numbers is, how strong is the signal from the Voyager spacecraft? Voyager's out there 12 billion miles. 40 years it has been traveling at roughly 40,000 miles an hour for 40 continuous years. 12 billion miles away. The signal coming out of Voyager by inverse square law has 315 decibels of loss. It's transmitting roughly a 10-watt signal. The amount of signal that's coming out of that 40 dB gain dish, the 12-foot diameter dish on Voyager, going down to a 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, with a state-of-the-art front end, and at 8.5 gigahertz, you're listening with a 150 hertz bandwidth receiver at 8.5 gigahertz in order to get 150 bits per second of data. 315 dB of loss. Let me drop. So gravity versus the strong force is 370 dB of difference. If the only signal I had to work with, you and I studying gravity on reasonable size objects, I got a 1 cubic centimeter of lead sitting on the desk, and it's got a certain amount of gravity, and by measuring that amount of gravity, I'm trying to figure out what gravity is, okay? The signal coming out of Voyager, 315 dB of loss. The signal is a small fraction of a microvolt when you use the tremendous gain of the transmitting antenna, the receiving antenna, the 20-watt transmitting traveling wave tube, 8.5 gigahertz, you put it all together. Tremendous amount of loss. If I had to study radio, and I had nothing to work with but the signal strength coming out of Voyager, minus 150 dBm is what comes out of that great big Goldstone dish. That's a weak signal. If I had nothing to study but that weak signal, and I try to figure out all the laws of radio, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it would take me a lifetime to try to come up with a couple of simple experiments that I could confirm what radio is. And here we are with 10 to the minus 37 amplitude of gravity wave versus the strong force, and we're trying to figure out what gravity is. We've got a real difficult problem there, and it's going to take a while. That's a guess on my part, Roy. AC2GS, KQLAW.
AC2GS. I don't know if it's the relative intensities that are the problem, because the strong force and the weak nuclear force both roll off at a very, 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 very small distance. They're particularly heavy force carriers, and so they can only exist under circumstances for a short duration and a short interval of space, whereas gravity goes on and on and on and on and on forever. So I don't think that's quite the problem. I think a lot of people are starting to scratch their head and trying to think of gravity not even as a force, but as a intrinsic quality of space-time itself that looks to us like a force, but really is something a wee bit different. And I don't know if we're evolved enough to kind of do stuff like that in our heads. So it might be a concept that requires further thinking to try and explain it to us.
Okay, let me add a couple of words about weakness. I've got a 1 kilogram chunk of lead sitting on the disc. And you and I can calculate the amount of gravity I'm going to experience when I put another massive object a couple of centimeters away. And we're talking about extremely small forces. So at the easily workable sizes of objects that I can study in a laboratory, the magnitude of gravity is so darn weak, it's extremely difficult to study. Gravity becomes a nice force when it comes to something as massive as the Earth. I'm 4,000 miles from the mass center of this Earth, 10 to the 37 kilograms. I've now got a reasonable amount of gravity, but now the object is so big, I can't move the object to run an experiment. I can't suddenly move the Earth an extra 10 miles away and find out what happens if I do it at a very rapid rate. So the weakness of gravity makes it very difficult to measure at the laboratory size. Where the gravity is strong enough, it's so far beyond gravity size, again, I can't manipulate it. If you can't manipulate the thing you're trying to measure, it's very difficult to come up with measurements that will confirm your theories as to what it is. A bunch of guesses. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Well, I agree with you. It makes laboratory practical experiments somewhere between difficult and impossible. But the joy of astrophysics is you see all of this enormous gravitational force interacting with local heavenly bodies in space. And yes, you can't set up the experiment by yourself, but you can posit different behaviors of planets and galaxies and other objects in the sky that do exist and see if your model correlates with the practical experiences detected. So it's not quite as good as a laboratory experiment unless you want to think of the universe as your lab.
We got to think big. So the universe is our lab, and yet every possible experiment, there's this universal law of physics, I don't think anyone's ever found an exception to it, which says that if you have a large enough amount of matter interacting for a long enough period of time, you'll get every possible reaction. The way they state it is every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. So in that universe, every possible reaction we can dream, and a lot of them that we haven't even dreamed of, is taking place somewhere. Build a big enough telescope, or its equivalent, and look at that chunk of the universe where that experiment is being done for you automatically by Mother Nature, and you're going to learn a lot. I mean, there are people who say, why are we spending all this money on Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope, $8 billion? Boy, we could feed a lot of people with that. The amount of real progress we make from those kinds of spacecraft, arguably the most productive thing that NASA has ever done, is to establish the Hubble Space Telescope. There are many people who feel that.
Repeater, timeout.
The so-called Hubble lovers. And pretty soon there's going to be a James Webb set of lovers. So when it comes to real progress and finding out how things work, you gotta not shortchange astronomy in its many forms, meaning DC to light, gamma ray and X-ray and optical and ultraviolet and infrared and radio and long wave radio and millimeter wave radio and gigahertz radio and so on, terahertz radio. You got it. Astronomy is arguably one of the most productive chunks of science in the world, which is the purest science, I think, in the world, because you can't easily earn a dollar with it, but if you pursue it with enthusiasm, it can give you an awful lot of answers as to what's going on in the universe. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
The trouble is that it's usually impossible to judge the value of research and even the findings, because at first we don't quite know what it means and what it leads to and what we can do with it. So initially, a lot of things started out as being worthless. When Lorentz did his Lorentz transformation mathematics, it was esoteric theoretical math, and it was interesting to mathematicians, but for the most part, people looked at it and said, that's useless garbage. And yet, if you can't use a Lorentz transform on the GPS satellite system, all those satellites would be worthless. So, you know, you can't put a price tag on information. Information tends to lead to more information, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You never quite know what you're going to get. And I'm always for more information because I've seen societies that are looking for less information, and I don't want to be part of those guys.
In general, they suffer in the long run. You can decide you're going to isolate yourself from the rest of the world, and you're going to pay a price. You've got to be part of the show, as I see it.
I agree entirely with you, Dick. I have a new book that I'm reading. It's called The Death of Expertise by a guy named Tom Nichols. It kind of goes into that, that we're living through a very weird time that people who are experts are in disdain. I wanted to mention to you after we do the black hole, that once again, a group of well-meaning people in California are telling people to be very cautious with their cell phones because their brains will glow in the dark.
Why don't you go into that one right now, Roy? That's a very current project, a very current subject as I see it. You got it right.
Okay, very well. I have lots of links today. So this link is radiation.limarktech.net. It'll have a nice little web page that sort of explains what's going on. The problem is that the California Department of Public Health issued a warning, especially for children, to stay away from cell phones whenever possible. They also issued guidelines on how to reduce exposure to the radio frequency energy. Now, they don't base it on any studies. They don't base it on pretty much any scientific research. They base it on a guy who's been suing people about it, and they've decided to be very cautious / overreact. So the problem is we live in a post-vaccination risk-averse imaginary world where you can't trust anything, especially the experts. So anyone who wants to take a look, it's radiation.limarktech.net. But that's the gist of it, that once again, they've issued a report that says that the radio frequency in cell phones can be damaging, especially to youngins.
That's a good common sense conclusion for a politician to come to. Unfortunately, it's based on the misunderstanding of a vocabulary word, radiation. As I've said a few times, if the early engineers on radio had called the signal that comes out of a radio antenna transmission, signaling, or whatever, used other words other than radiation, yes, it does go out in all directions. Yes, it does radiate. Radiation is a perfectly good word in 1900. Along comes 1940-something or other, when we have nuclear radiation, and people start equating nuclear-weighted radiation, which is little particles, atomic-sized particles coming out of a object at near the speed of light, penetrating your body like microscopic bullets, damaging your DNA in many cases, and potentially creating cancer. Radio is not a particle. It's a wave. When that wave hits your body, it has nothing as its ability but to create some heating if the wave is very strong. We put our food in a microwave oven. We don't worry about the food becoming radioactive and becoming carcinogenic. The amount of signal in that microwave oven is close to a billion times stronger than the signal you would get from a cell phone base station if you lived directly next door to it. And we worry about the radiation from the base station creating cancer, and yet a billion times stronger radio signal in your microwave oven is cooking your food, and we don't worry about the food being changed in its chemistry because of these radiation particles, so to speak. I'm being facetious with that word, particle. Not a particle, it's a wave. And we don't worry about the nuclear radiation coming out of your microwave oven. I think I told you guys that there was a serious guy. He wasn't kidding. One of the members of the Long Island Consultants Network, who is a computer expert, who asked me, as a so-called radio expert, how long must I wait to let for the half-life of my food when I bring it out of the microwave oven so that it's safe for me to eat? He literally asked me that question. I think I told you the answer is a nanosecond. That's how long it takes for the last cycle out of the magnetron tube to die down as you're opening up the door. So we've got a vocabulary problem here. The word radiation is creating a unnecessary fear and unnecessary misinterpretation. And to compare a radio wave to a nuclear wave is not apple and orange. You're comparing an apple to a pencil. AC2GS, K2LIW. That was a bunch of opinions on my part.
AC2GS, and opinions I agree with. The problem is in semantics, and the problem is that we really need to make Americans smarter. You know, we can play games. I'm sure you probably mentioned, that long ago there was this thing called nuclear magnetic resonance. And it was used in laboratories, and chemistry, we used it when I was doing chemistry. And some very smart guy at Downstate and a few other guys figured out that they could use it as imaging for human beings. But they couldn't call it nuclear magnetic resonance because it had that word nuclear in it, and it scared people. So they just renamed it magnetic resonance imaging. It's the same exact technology. It really doesn't have anything to do with radioactiveness. It has to do with RF and magnetic fields. The name is the only thing that counts, unfortunately, because we don't want to educate our populace. They need to be smarter. These are days where you need to know how stuff works.
WS2N.
You got it, Paul.
Dick, I don't know if you remember. Why don't you use the analogy? Remember life insurance and death insurance that you used to have?
Yeah, in the beginning, it really was called death insurance, and it was very hard to sell. So by inverting the word to life insurance, all of a sudden it becomes easier to sell. But death insurance literally pays you a benefit when somebody dies. It really is death insurance. And nuclear magnetic resonance, as played around with by Dr. Damadian at Downstate Medical Center, roughly 1969 time frame, I was working with Dr. John Fox of Downstate Medical Center at that time, who was just down the hall from Damadian and telling me what he was discovering with this method of imaging inside of a body, non-destructive imaging, which doesn't have the potential dangers of an X-ray machine. And poor old Mr. Damadian didn't get as much credit as I think he deserved. But so even though we call it magnetic resonance imaging, it really is nuclear magnetic resonance that's being measured by that machine. And then nowadays, the high-resolution versions of that, my goodness, can that give very nice three-dimensional pictures, essentially non-destructively, of what's going on deep inside of a human being when it comes to diagnosing and analyzing grief. Boy, that machine, too bad it's not a little bit cheaper, because it can do magic. I bet you've seen some NMR pictures that are really mind-blowing, haven't you, Dr. Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW?
Yes, I have. For the most part, I've seen slice pictures, but it's theoretically possible to put them in 3D and rotate them and do all kinds of fun stuff that I assume radiologists do when no one's watching them. But for us poor mortals, they usually give us sliced versions of it. But it was a great breakthrough. But again, if you called it nuclear magnetic resonance, there would probably be guys in California issuing warnings about the whole darn thing. It's kind of dubious. So you know, we still have these superstitious, nonsensical fears of the unknown, and not quite the desire to make things known. So we just sit around and we're afraid of stuff.
There is a slight risk factor to an NMR machine. The higher resolution machines use a stronger magnetic field. I think the medium versions, I think, use 1.5 Tesla or something like that, maybe up to 3 Tesla. There is a version of the machine that goes up to 7 Tesla. I know somebody who was adjusting one of those machines, and he told me that when he put his head into the 7 Tesla magnetic field, maybe it was psychosomatic, but every time he did it, he could taste the fillings in his mouth. It had that as a function of many effects. And here's a guess on my part, Roy. Maybe you can confirm or deny this one. Let me drop it. Whenever you put a person into an NMR machine, MRI machine, you put him on this table, which is motorized, and the table slowly backs the person into the magnet to begin the measurement. It is my belief the reason they do it that way, and your head is usually clamped down so you can't move it very fast, for reasons of not getting a blurry picture, but there's a secondary reason. The protoplasm inside of your cranium is a very salty, bloody, very conductive solution. Whenever you put a conducting object into a strong magnetic field, by Faraday's law, if you move the object, you're going to generate a voltage. There are people I know who have managed to move their head rapidly in an MRI machine or NMR machine, you know what I mean, and they've gotten some psychedelic effects. You can literally do yourself a kind of electroshock therapy if in that strong magnetic field you move your head fast enough. Therefore, they want to make sure you move slowly so as not to get that effect. I wonder if you've heard anyone discuss it that way, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on the side. There isn't too much wonderful stuff written up on a theoretical basis. They're more anecdotal, but it makes perfect sense to me. It's Faraday's law in action. Any movement within a magnetic field, whether the magnetic field moves and you stay stable or vice versa, is going to induce current, and brains are very sensitive to microvolts of potential. You fire the wrong bunch of neurons and you'll trigger memories, you'll trigger motor function, you'll trigger sensory functions. There are guys who sit and put magnets, electromagnets, over people's foreheads, and by locating them in particular places and sending a signal long enough, it kind of fatigues the neurons, and you can change a person's behavior for a short period of time. Again, it sounds like something from science fiction, but they've done it repeatedly.
There have been a couple of PBS programs displaying some of that going on. And sometimes they're putting pulsed signals into those electromagnets that are mounted on a person's head. In some cases, it can help them analyze things like epilepsy, I believe, and maybe, or I can't think of this other disease that John... the star of the science fiction program. Can't even think of the name of the program. Forgetting everything tonight, but what I'm getting at is there are certain kinds of analysis you can do that way, which I think can be therapeutic and can be analytic. And so my guess is it's a little bit vague, because in order to properly focus that magnetic field at a particular point in the person's brain, I think that's relatively difficult from the outside of the cranium. W-Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big problems. It's right now we have a sledgehammer. We don't have a fine needle. We have a sledgehammer, and so we can do crude things. We can do things on the surface, but for stuff that's below the surface, that's in small areas, occasionally you'll read papers of during brain surgery where they keep the patient awake and they introduce electrodes. They're able to induce all kinds of things that we kind of take for granted are the way we're thinking. You know, he'll remember his aunt Matilda's chocolate chip cake mix or something. It's just all of a sudden from a couple of microvolts in the right space. So, yeah, as time goes on and we learn to finesse it more and more, there's, of course, the danger of abusing it. as there is with anything. Now they're kind of cloning pets, so for X number of dollars, you can buy a clone of your favorite dog or cat. So, you know, that's the good side. Who knows what the bad side is? Technology is like a hammer. You could build a house with it, or you could cave in someone's skull.
But to repeat what you said earlier, Roy, this California organization thinks they're doing useful work. And they think by restricting a cell phone from young children, and they think by convincing people to avoid being near or an operating cell phone for long periods of time, they think they're really protecting the public. There have been a large number of studies looking for the deleterious effect of cell phones. And with rare exception, I mean, we got to look at the risk-benefit ratio. No matter what you do, no matter how safe it is, it can be misused. A significant number of pledging college students die on some years because in the pledging process, they're put into a competition where who can drink the most amount of clear, cold water in a hurry. And you put a large amount of water in your body too rapidly, and it can become life-threatening. So even water, clean water, can be unsafe. So is there any danger to a cell phone? I think all of the current real measured data, and we've now got 30 years of data, says if there is a risk factor, it's extremely small. The risk-to-benefit ratio, the number of people whose lives have been saved because of a cell phone. Let me drop it. Number of people whose lives have been saved because of a cell phone, as opposed to the number of people whose bodies have been damaged because of a cell phone. That might be a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio. And therefore, the risk-to-benefit ratio, if there is a risk, and it's very difficult to define that risk. I mean, we're talking about an epidemiological study. If there is a risk, similar to cigarette smoking. Cigarette smoking, it takes maybe 10 years for the full deleterious effects to happen on your lungs because you're a smoker. And if there is a risk with cell phone, maybe it also takes 10 or 20 years. But in the case of cigarette smoking, after 10 or 20 years, you had a lot of evidence that it was creating damage, even though people were trying to deny it. In the case of cell phones, I don't think we've got that evidence. I've seen an awful lot of articles where people have looked for the evidence and couldn't find it. Of course, lack of evidence is not the lack of the effect being there. It's very difficult to prove a negative. But still, my impression is that the wave, the very weak, fraction of a watt wave coming out of a cell phone, doesn't have any of the stealth and cunning to be able to do damage to a human being. AC2GS, K2LIW, go ahead, Roy.
Well, I think it's a matter of political expediency on their part. They know that if they take this approach, they won't really get any problems because the people who want to will use it, and the people who don't want to will say, aha, that's what, you know, they're trying to keep this knowledge from us. And, you know, if it ends up to them in their mind being like cigarette smoking, in 10, 20 years they find out, or like asbestos, how dangerous it is, they can't be kind of put on the carpet for it. So they cover their backsides. And getting to water intoxication is a kind of fascinating thing. I actually treated a guy. It was psychogenic on his part. He couldn't stop himself from drinking water. And anything, too much of anything is not good. Too much oxygen is no good. Too much water is no good. There's pretty much nothing that too much of doesn't kill you.
How about money? Or blondes? Maybe they're not destructive in large quantities, though, Roy?
I don't know about that. I know more than a few guys who didn't end up well after their exposure to those things. And I don't want to call blondes things, but you get the idea.
Yeah, some musicians suddenly became nouveau riche, and because they couldn't control the situation very well, their own psychological effects, what we're looking for now, willpower and so on, you can get yourself into an awful lot of trouble. it looks like Elvis Presley, for instance, had enough money to be able to order enough people to give him enough chemistry, and the same thing with Michael Jackson, to get himself into trouble. So a lot of money that's not properly controlled can be lethal. Over to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Yeah, the most depressing report, and there's a lot of depressing things in the news, is when they interview these people who won the lottery, and it seems like a dream come true. You know, these are guys who change light bulbs for a living, or they're taxi cab drivers, or they work at the post office, and all of a sudden they get a check for $50 million, $100 million, $150 million. It almost never ends well. You know, they'll interview them a few years down the road. They'll have no money left. They'll be bankrupt, and their entire family won't be talking to them for whatever reason. Sometimes it's the biggest curse. It seems like a blessing, but in the wrong hands, even blessings can become curses.
Our subjects tonight are a little bit divergent, but anybody in within the sound of our voice, Roy and mine and Paul's, you're allowed to ask any question that's even closely related to the things you've just heard. Clarification of what you've heard or similar sounding questions. Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW and AC2GS listening. Okay, Wes is one person with a question. Anyone else? Looks like you're the only one. You got it, Wes.
Yeah, talking about cell phones, we could see how much energy in joules, or what is the frequency of one single electromagnetic wave that would have the energy of one electron volt, which electron volt would be the amount of energy gained or lost by the charge of a single electron moving across the electric potential difference of 1 volt, which is completely harmless. Then when we look at the table, we can find out that in visible light, red color is 1.98 to 1.59 of electron volts. So I see nonsense of picking up the subject of looking up.
And let me interrupt you on this one, Wes. You're going down a very logical path, but you're reinventing a wheel that already exists. The American National Standards Institute, for the last 60 years, has been publishing something called the C95 report. It's updated every year or two or three. It represents the electromagnetic biohazard radiation assessment for the United States. That report, the C95 report of ANSI, A-N-S-I, American National Standard Institute. Let me drop. They have been studying the electromagnetic effects of the biohazard, and they don't use electron volts. They go the next step beyond that. They use power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter or volts per meter. And so they have, for each individual frequency region, they've now figured out with rather high precision what amount of exposure creates what amount of grief on a human being. It turns out that the Biological Hazard Board of the United Kingdom has a similar report. Japan has a similar report. Scandinavia has a similar report. If you compare each of their reports to the American C95 report, they all hang together. They've all come to very similar conclusions. So when it comes to how much RF energy, for what period of time, exposed to what portion of a human being, the C95 report is not easy to read. Oh, it's about 200 pages in pretty dense engineering terms. Lots of diagrams, but it's updated every couple of years. It is the defining document for the Department of Defense, for OSHA, NIOSH, and all these American agencies. It is the defining document for the United States. So they've gone beyond the step of electron volts. It's volts per meter and milliwatts per square centimeter, so to speak, versus what amount of exposure in time. WS2N2XJN, K2RW, go ahead, West.
I completely agree with you. What I was trying to point is that energy level at red, the frequency of the visible light is much higher, and that would be 1.6 times 10 to minus 19 of joules, than the 2.4 megahertz of 5, I'm sorry, 2.4 gigahertz of 5 gigahertz of solar tower. It is the proximity and density that actually matters. But yeah, you can use much recognized form of identification of that field. So if that not is not a question, then I would like to pick up gravity as a second order of relativistic manifestation of electrostatic force by Cornell University. Dr. Roy knows what I'm talking about.
Well, getting back to the last thing, the problem is you can't prove a negative. And when people are frightened, you can't rationalize with them. You can't assuage them by logic. And so since you can't 100% prove it negative, even though you can't show any evidence whatsoever, you are still going to have people who are going to run around yelling that the sky is falling. And that's the problem we're having in vaccinations. Who knows how many thousands of children will get very sick and some will die because they're not being vaccinated, because they're afraid of autism, when there is no proof whatsoever that autism has anything to do with vaccination. And that's the irrationality in our lives today, both on the right, on the left, in the middle. It's human nature. We have these strange little quirks, and we need better education, in my humble opinion.
Let me say a couple words on vaccination right now, Roy. Let me drop this. In Newsday in the last week, they talked about the fact that there seems to be a beginning, almost epidemic, of the of flu in New York State. They've already reported, I believe it's 1,800 cases of flu in New York State, 1,600 or 1,800, I forget what the number was, and 600 of those people required hospitalization. That's approximately one person in three. Yeah, I think it's 1,600 cases and 600 hospitalizations. So they're strongly recommending, even though it's not thoroughly effective, they're recommending that the majority of people who are smart should be taking the flu shot. And I've heard tell that there is a slightly stronger flu shot that's recommended for people over 65 years of age. I wonder if you heard about this super flu shot for over 65s. And if you go to Walgreens or any of your other local apothecaries, are they offering that particular flu shot, or do you have to go to your PCP to get it? Over to you on that one, Roy. K2RW.
I'm not sure if Walgreens and such provide that. You probably need to give them a phone call. I don't see why they shouldn't offer it as an option. Yeah, the idea with influenza is very difficult to deal with because influenza viruses are very flexible, and they change the coating on the outside and sneak past all your antibodies. And so every generation, every variation on a theme, it requires another type of vaccine, and so it's very changeable. But there are other things that aren't changeable. You know, polio was the great success story of vaccination, but there are people not being vaccinated, and there are people actually suffering from polio in the world. We all kind of think of it as a dead disease, but it's not dead. These things never really truly die, and if we stop looking and we stop vaccinating, we risk a lot of problems down the road. But the influenza, the stronger one, especially for higher risk people, is a good idea.
And sure, it would be nice if that's the one that could be offered by Walgreens or Rite Aid. There, I don't know. I'd have to do some checking on that one. Maybe I've got to go back to my PCP on that one, Roy.
Thank you. again, my guess would be if you just called up Walgreens or whatever and asked them, they would probably be able to tell you what they have available. They might stock that.
You already have heard about the slightly different vaccination that's required, that's recommended for people over 65. You've heard that already? Because I just read it in Newsday, and that's brand new information to me. I didn't know. No, that was on PBS recently, one day ago. I didn't know that there's two different versions of the vaccination for a flu.
A comment, KC1SAM.
Roy, please, and then Sam. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, it's very common that there's more than one formulation of influenza vaccination each season. There are trivalent with three different viral strains. There are quadrivalent with four strains. And the strains picked are kind of educated guesses on the part of epidemiologists, kind of guessing, you know, 3 months ahead of time what the major groups of infection are. So there's always sort of been, at least for the last 15 years I can think of, a higher risk vaccination choices. It may not be publicized, and your doctor may not discuss the nuances with you, but they've been around for a while.
I didn't know that the consumer had the choice. I thought that the smart people at the FDA or whoever choose the vaccine they're going to use this year for the whole United States. That was my previous impression. Mr. SAM, you got it. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. The standard flu vax, you really don't have a choice for the average person. That's a quadrivalent. I think for over 60, it's a high potency. I think it's four times the potency, but it's only a trivalent. And Rite Aid pharmacies, at least in Connecticut, does carry that. KC1SAM, back over to you.
Is there a risk-to-benefit ratio of which one you choose, Sam? How does a person who is over 65, as I am, make the choice if I have a choice? Or do they automatically give me a particular one because they find out what my age is? Over to you, Sam.
Well, I am as well. And the reason you take the high-potency one is because as you get older, your immune system is a little less efficient. So the high-potency one kind of gives it a little extra kick. And hopefully you'll get a better reaction from that one and build up the immunity. I guess you could go in and say, I'll just take the regular one. But it's advantageous to you to take the high-potency one.
And Rite Aid seems to offer that. That's good information, Sam. Roy, it is my guess. Let me drop. It's my guess that the immune system of a human being takes a certain length of time to develop the full immunity after getting the flu shot. And maybe that period is 3 weeks. So in the ideal world, you get the shot 3 weeks before you're going to be exposed to the flu, if this was the ideal world. Is there any disadvantage of getting the flu shot where you didn't know you've already been exposed but don't show any symptoms yet? Is there any disadvantage of getting the flu shot at the same time that the flu is developing in your body, and your body doesn't have the chance to really develop its immunity by the normal pathway? AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Dr. Roy.
I don't recall seeing anything specific in the literature, but my gut feeling would be that it wouldn't be advantageous. It wouldn't be like providing the body with an alternative infection that's benign and kind of crowding out the bad virus. If you already have the infective strain in your system replicating inside the cells, chances are the vaccination would not be terribly effective in causing your immune system to act any quicker, and probably would give you a little bit more side effects. So, you know, you might make a case for taking the vaccine if there's a high risk of you developing the flu in, say, a week or 10 days. But if you already have the flu, taking the vaccine probably doesn't give you any benefit and a slight dash of risk.
What percentage of the population in our area do you think has taken the flu shot? And if this was the best of all worlds, do you believe 100% of us should all take the shot? Do you have a feeling on that one, Roy?
Well, the beauty of vaccination is you don't necessarily have to give 100% of the population the vaccine. If you're somehow able to talk, you know, something like 60 or 70 into the vaccine, then you break apart the epidemiological aspects of the infection enough that you kind of got a handle on it if it's 100% effective, of course. So, you know, in all cases, everyone would sort of like it 100% vaccine, because then you don't have to deal with the probabilistic aspects. But in reality, I would be amazed if, say, more than 15 to 20% of the population is vaccinated on a yearly basis. I mean, they even have problems in hospitals making sure that everyone gets vaccinated. And there, it's really important.
So you think 15 or 20%... are vaccinated, which is too low to really have the effectiveness that we want. And I think some hospitals force their staff to wear a mask if they're not vaccinated. So I presume there are people in medicine who for some reason refuse to take the vaccination. Maybe they're allergic to egg whites, so to speak, and they're afraid of Guillain-Barré, I think it's pronounced. Go ahead, Roy.
I mean, Guillain-Barré syndrome is a real thing. I've treated people in intensive care units. It can get very scary. If you remember the pseudo-influenza epidemic back in the mid-80s, there was a whole slew of, unfortunately, people suffering Guillain-Barré. And people with allergies to egg yolk, if that's the source of the antigen. There's a bunch of reasons, but, you know, masks are fine, but masks are not perfect. And, you know, what I think everyone wants to at least do at the very least is to increase the percentages of the high-risk group to be vaccinated. So you're not going to do away with influenza anytime soon, but it can do terrible things in nursing homes. One person comes down with influenza on a floor, and they end up with pneumonia, and they end up dying. There's an incredible death rate in nursing homes on some floors during the flu season.
Yeah, I know somebody who got the Guillain-Barré syndrome back in the late 70s or early 80s, and after a flu shot. And the person was complaining about breathing didn't seem to give them the usual benefit. The body didn't want to automatically breathe. They had to basically force themselves to breathe because the body wasn't doing it as an autonomic response. It only lasted for about 2 hours, but it scared the living daylight out of this friend of mine. Over to you, Roy.
Well, in a way, he was a lucky guy because, yes, ascending paralysis is a common finding with Guillain-Barré to different degrees. Some people just have, you know, weakness in an extremity. Other people have to be, unfortunately, put on respirators. And you know, there's no real treatment per se. I mean, people throw steroids at everyone for everything because they can't just sit there. And they wait, and it's usually resolves by itself, and you wean people off those respirators. But it's scary at one point, you know, when a perfectly healthy person goes in for a vaccination thinking that it's a good thing, and then having this very idiosyncratic reaction that medical science isn't 100% sure what the heck is about. Yeah, it could be very scary.
The person who has to be put on a respirator, is that a temporary condition where in most cases, after some period of time, the body does thoroughly recover from that? Question number one. And question number two, have there been any changes in the method of producing the vaccine that makes Guillain-Barré less likely today? Over to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, most of the time it reverses. It may not reverse the total baseline. So you have different presentations. I mean, there are some people, unfortunately, who never recover, very sad cases. But most people tend to recover to a certain degree. They might have a little weakness in one extremity that kind of carries through for the rest of their lives. and you can never really predict it. And although we have been fortunate, the amount of Guillain-Barré from influenza vaccines is very, very much smaller than they once were. They've changed the formulation on many different aspects of it. And again, no one, I think, is quite sure what it is that gave us the big numbers for that influenza vaccine. But thankfully, it hasn't been duplicated.
Well, if I understand you correctly, the vaccine of, say, 1973 or whenever it was, did have a high percentage of, like a one person for 10,000 of Guillain-Barré. Is that what you're saying? And now the numbers are a small fraction of that?
Yes, for some odd reason, around the late 70s, early 80s, there was some kind of a scare of a influenza pandemic, and the powers that be really banged the drums to make sure everyone got vaccinated. And there was, you know, it could have been a statistical aberration. Again, no one's quite sure, but we saw a lot of Guillain-Barré in that very short period of time, relatively speaking. I mean, it was still an infinitesimal number, thankfully. But it was enough that just about everyone was involved with someone with Guillain-Barré.
Wow, I didn't know it was that high. So you make it sound like it's considerably higher than one person per 10,000.
Well, I don't recall the percentages, and also it depends on the extent. If you allow for people with very mild temporary muscle weakness, obviously the number gets bigger and bigger. But, you know, it's kind of like these were fascinating things that everyone sort of remembers, especially people who worked in hospital. So anyone in the hospital when there was a Guillain-Barré in the intensive care unit kind of knew all about him. It's the same thing that when AIDS just kind of popped up out of nowhere. I remember we were treating people in Kings County for this very esoteric form of cancer that usually afflicts elderly Ashkenazi Jews. And it was killing people in the Haitian community. And this is before we had any idea about HIV and AIDS. So, you know, the fascinating things tend to spread and everyone and their mother learns about them. And that's what was going on with Guillain-Barré. Everyone knew about these guys in the intensive care unit.
In the case of Guillain-Barré, did the early onset of the symptoms occur 1 hour, 1 day, 3 days after the evacuation? Was there a approximate period of time which, if it was going to happen, it would happen, and therefore a person who's being very conservative would make sure he's located around the right location, around the right people, available to the right facilities at that time? If it takes 3 days to occur, then should you be a little bit more careful on that third day, so to speak? Is that kind of information known now, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's that immediate. I think it's involved with the entire function of the vaccine ramping up your immune system. And unfortunately, as it ramps up your immune system for influenza, it also ramps up your immune system for your neurons and screws up the receptor sites and activation sites and leaves your motor neurons weaker and weaker as the antibodies flood your system. So it probably runs in the same line with the developing immunity to the influenza that the vaccine is based on. So you're not going to get kind of 24 hours. If it hasn't happened then, it's not going to happen. It sneaks up on you for a couple of weeks.
So you have reason to believe that the people who were afflicted, the affliction was a couple of weeks after the inoculation, is what I think you're saying, as a typical number.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an overnight thing. It could happen in less than a couple of weeks. Again, there's a bell curve, and there's more severe and less severe. But it's usually a week or 2 weeks, around the same time that your own immune system is kind of ramping up for the influenza. So it's the same sort of mechanism, and that's kind of why the vaccine is the thing that tends to trigger it. There's no other medication, to my understanding, that triggers the same noxious result.
Have you been vaccinated this year so far, Roy?